All right, I'd like you to take your Bible this morning and turn to Romans chapter 8. When we do it God's way, He wants us to be the head and not the tail. In the next two messages, we're going to talk more about how and the kingdom will be ours once again.
Welcome to Mission to Israel, a broadcast ministry featuring author, teacher, and evangelist Ted R. Weiland. The focus of this ministry is to open the eyes of our people and give insight into the issues we find ourselves facing in this day and age. Our address is Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scotts Bluff, Nebraska 69363, or you can reach us via the web at www.missiontoisrael.org. And now, here's Ted Weiland.
All right, 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 17 and 18. Let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of a double honor, especially they who labor in the word and doctrine, for the Scripture saith, Thou shalt not muzzle the ox that treadeth out the corn, and the laborer is worthy of his reward. This will be Kingdom Tithing, part 13. I'd like us to take our Bibles this morning and turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 31. 2 Chronicles chapter 31 to begin the message. To begin what will be the conclusion, if I can get through all I need to get through. 2 Chronicles chapter 31, where we find Hezekiah, king of Judah, restoring the kingdom of Yahweh. 2 Chronicles 31, beginning with verse 1, it says, Now when all of this was finished, all Israel that were present went out to the cities of Judah, and break the images in pieces, and cut down the groves, and threw down the high places, and the altars out of all Judah, and Benjamin, and Ephraim also, and Manasseh, until they had utterly destroyed them all. Then all the children of Israel returned, every man to his possession, into their own cities. First, I want you to note here, before we read a little bit further, that whereas it was Hezekiah's intent to restore Yahweh's kingdom, we need to understand that it was not because Yahweh's kingdom had gone out of existence. Yahweh had not ceased being king. He was still king, and he was still ultimate sovereign during Hezekiah's father, Ahaz's reign, who did not right in the sight of Yahweh, and the kingdom, or at least parts thereof, or at least it became something other than what God did not intend or want it to be. No, the kingdom, even during Ahaz's reign and others like him, still existed. It was just that Ahaz and others like him had contributed to its sad state of affairs here on earth. Hezekiah was simply restoring it to its proper biblical parameters or condition. Lesson for us. The fact that things are in a mess today doesn't mean that Yahweh's been kicked off his throne. And if he still reigns, his kingdom is still in existence, regardless how bad things are. You know, if I could remember the tune, and it's a great song. I think it's even in our songbooks, but I can't remember how it goes, and I can't read music. But if I could remember the song, Our God Reigns, I'd sing it. Our God Reigns, you know. Is that only the kind of song you sing when things are good? Or does our God reign even during times that are bad? His kingdom's not gone. We don't have to wait for his kingdom. We just got to get about the business like Hezekiah was of restoring his kingdom. The second thing I want you to note about verse 1 is that Hezekiah and the people understood that rebuilding the kingdom began with tearing down all of the high places. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 4 and 5. Isn't that what our commission is as well? To tear down all of the high places? It's no different today of those opposed to Yahweh. But Hezekiah obviously also understood to rebuild the kingdom only began there with tearing down the high places of those opposed to Yahweh. He understood that building Yahweh's kingdom entailed more than just tearing down, but building. Building the kingdom entailed building as well. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and as we find in Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 3, to everything there is a season, a time and every purpose under heaven. Verse 3, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to tear down, and a time to build up. There's lots of people in the business about tearing down, but it's time that we get beyond that, or at least start to get beyond that, and start at least talking about building up as well. And so after tearing down, Hezekiah got after the task of building or rebuilding, as the case was for him. Now, with that in mind, let's look at verses 2 through 4. Chapter 31, verse 2. And Hezekiah, now note where he began. They began with tearing down all of the idols and the high places that represented them. But then note where it begins in rebuilding. And Hezekiah, verse 2, and Hezekiah appointed the courses of the priests and the Levites after their courses, every man according to his service. Where did he begin? By reinstalling the Levites and the priests. Every man according to his service, the priests and the Levites for burnt offerings and for peace offerings, to minister and to give thanks and to praise in the gates of the tents of Yahweh. He appointed also the king's portion of his substance for the burnt offerings, to wit, for the morning and evening burnt offerings, and the burnt offerings for the Sabbaths, and for the new moons, and for the set feast, as it is written in the law of Yahweh. And then in verse 4 it says, moreover, he commanded the people that dwelt in Jerusalem to give the portion of the priests and the Levites. What's he talking about? Tithes and offerings. That they, the Levites and the priests, might be encouraged in the law of Yahweh. That they might be encouraged. He says, we've got to place the priest. It begins by putting the priest and the Levites back into their rightful places, and then providing for them, giving them their portion out of the tithes and offerings, that they might be encouraged in the law. Why? Simply for encouragement's sake? For encouragement's sake? No, but that they also might be about their king's business of rebuilding the kingdom. Now, what do you suppose occurs when the people didn't give their portion to the priests and the Levites? That the Levites and the priests are set up, but what do you think what do you think would happen or did happen when, with the priests and the Levites set up in their position, and the people didn't give their portion to the priests and the Levites? Do you think that the kingdom maybe went a-wanting? Or went wanting? Of course it did. That's inevitable. Turn to Nehemiah, two books over. Nehemiah chapter 13. And you don't have to take my word for it or rest on your own wisdom. We can read it right here. Nehemiah chapter 13, beginning with verse 10. And Nehemiah said, and by the way, Nehemiah's here now in the same process of rebuilding the kingdom. And in verse 10 of chapter 13, he says, and I perceived that the portions of the Levites had not been given them. For the Levites, how did he figure that? For, he says, or because, the Levites and the singers that did the work were fled, every one to his own field. Then contended I with them and said, why is the house of God forsaken? Or he was saying, why is the kingdom forsaken? The house of God, the kingdom was being forsaken. Why? Well, the priests and the Levites and the singers, who were a part of that same bunch, had fled to their own properties because they were obviously unable to provide otherwise for themselves and their families. Perhaps they had even got to the point of starving, and they said, hey, if nobody's going to provide for us, we got to provide for our own or be worse than infidels. And so they went to their own fields. Why? Well, very simply, because the people had forsaken their responsibility to support the kingdom workers with their tithes and offerings, so that they, the kingdom workers, might forego other work, as also described by Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 6, if you'll recall, where he says, or do only I and Barnabas have the right not to refrain from working something outside of the kingdom work? Do we have, is it only us that have the right to refrain from this other kind of work? And it was a rhetorical question. Of course, it applied to Peter, and it applied to Barnabas and many others in that day and age as well, which, by the way, is but another New Testament proof with what we find in these two Old Testament passages for a New Covenant tithe. That ties it back to the New Covenant tithe as well. And the fact is, it is no different today. We have a dearth of full-time kingdom workers, kingdom laborers, for the same reason. We don't have a dearth of pulpit ministers, but we've got a dearth of kingdom laborers today, and the kingdom today suffers as a result. You know, we're more than happy to pray as a quote-unquote Christian people, we're more than happy to pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. But how many of us are doing more than just praying, including tithing, to make it happen? In the same fashion, we are more than happy to pray for laborers, the fields being white for harvest, and they are. But how many of us are doing more than just praying, including tithing, to make it happen? By the way, I don't know if you've ever considered this or not, but those two prayers are one and the same. To pray for laborers here on earth is to pray for Yahweh's kingdom here on earth. And to pray for Yahweh's kingdom here on earth is ultimately to pray for more laborers here on earth as well. Also, to pray for the kingdom and kingdom laborers, but to do nothing else to make it happen, is essentially the same idea that someone came up with as those who will give the Lord credit, but won't give Him cash. Essentially the same idea. Now, hopefully, this series has convinced people to give Yahweh more than just credit. Beginning with giving themselves, because this is where it all begins. If you haven't given yourselves completely to Him, because if you haven't given yourselves completely to Him, it's not likely that you're going to be a tither. And that the kingdom tithe, hopefully as a result of this series, people have become convinced that the kingdom tithe is still applicable to today. And that if they have an increase, they have a kingdom responsibility as it concerns 10% of their profits. And actually, as you see, it's really more than 10%. But more than a responsibility, the tithe is a trust. A trust to those who receive it, that they will employ it faithfully to the best of their ability in advancing the kingdom. Not just building churches, not just building monuments to themselves or whatever it is, but that they will be faithful and to the best of their ability use that which has been entrusted to them both by Yahweh and by the people to advance Yahweh's kingdom here on earth. But it is also a trust to the giver as well, that He'll do His best to make sure it's going, the tithe He does provide, that it's going to where it will be used most efficiently and effectively for advancing the kingdom. Mark Rushdoony in God's Kingdom Tax put it in the following fashion. He said, quote, Godly works are often underfunded. Because people give to emotional appeals rather than the godliness of a work as part of their own disciplined tithing. End of quote. And how true and how unfortunate, and that's not the best word, that is more often the case probably than it is otherwise. Which, by the way, doesn't mean, because this can be the fast conclusion on this, But this, it doesn't mean that all of it, always goes to a national kingdom ministry. The tithe we're talking about. Some of it might be best employed in a local work that's not tied in with any particular ministry. And note, I didn't say local church, but local work. Because unless the local church is both pronomian and pro-kingdom, which is very difficult to find in these days in which we live, it's not a work that deserves any part of the kingdom tithe. And so it may not even be for a local church. But that doesn't mean there can't be a local kingdom work that's pursuing the kingdom and is doing something that the tithe would be worthy to give to in a local sense for some of our people out there. Furthermore, not all tithes go to today's ministers anyway. Remember, there are three tithes. Three tithes. The first tithe, what might be called the minister's tithe, or I prefer, and you'll see hopefully why as we get further into this, I prefer to call it the worker's tithe, which under the old covenant was an every year tithe, except for the sabbatical and jubilee year, particularly for farmers. The second tithe, or what's often called the poor tithe, or the tithe given principally for the poor and the widows and the orphans and the needy strangers, probably best, I think, termed, although I can see why some people would maybe refrain from doing so or shy from doing so, but probably best called the welfare tithe, is a tithe required every 3 years. And then the third tithe, or what's usually called the rejoicing tithe, is another yearly tithe to be spent principally on oneself and one's family. So let's briefly discuss each of these in a little more detail so that we understand these tithes a little bit better. The minister's or worker's tithe, as I prefer, which we have basically spent the majority of the series dealing with more than the other tithes, is not a tithe that goes exclusively to ministers like myself, as we normally think of the word ministers. It's a tithe that should be designated to kingdom workers. As in 2 Chronicles chapter 34 and verses 9 and 10, as an old covenant type of where it should be going today, at least as one of the passages I like to use in this regard because of the language that's used here. Let me read it to you. I think we've read it before, but let me read it to you again. It says, "And when they came to Hilkiah the high priest, they delivered the money that was brought into the house of God, which the Levites that kept the doors had gathered of the hand of Manasseh and Ephraim, and of all the remnant of Israel, and of all Judah and Benjamin, and they returned to Jerusalem. And they put it in the hand of the workmen that had the oversight of the house of Yahweh, and they gave it to the workmen that wrought in the house of the Lord, or in the house of Yahweh, to prepare and amend the house." End of quote. Kingdom workers, laborers, kingdom workers who, when, talking about today now, kingdom workers who, when Christians are controlling, are governing, or ruling the kingdom, will be provided the tithe money, at least this first tithe money. In other words, it will be used to compensate or to capitalize, if you prefer, more than merely ministers of the gospel of the kingdom. You know, the churches today who are teaching the tithe, they very seldom do you find them teach all three tithes. And even if they did, they'd still probably somehow get that all into the minister's hands or the church that represents those ministers. But this tithe is meant for much more than today than the ministers of the gospel. In fact, when the kingdom is in the hands of Christians, that is governed by the Christians, only 10%, when that is become the fact of the land, only 10% of the overall first tithe will go to the ministers of the gospel. We're not going to go there, but that's established in Numbers chapter 10 and verse 38, where the first tithe went to the Levites, and the Levites took 10% of that tithe and tithed it to the priests. And therefore, as we normally think of as ministers of God, under this system, when Christians are in control, only 10% of the tithe, of the first tithe, would then go to ministers of the gospel, such as myself. The remaining 90% will go to those who labor in maintaining the kingdom and administering, that is, implementing and executing kingdom laws. For example, among others, but particularly, it'll go to judges and court officers, etc., such as those kinds of laborers. It will also go toward administration costs and other kingdom expenses that it will also have to be used for. That 90% of that first tithe goes to those kinds of laborers and workers and others as well, and to those administration costs. However, as I believe I pointed out earlier in this series, just briefly, we are in a situation today where, because we don't have control of the civil body politic, as with nearly all of Yahweh's laws today, we're attempting to apply biblical law in what amounts to a Babylonian system, with less, more often than not, less than desirable results. Trying to apply biblical law, because we don't have dominion, in what's essentially a Babylonian system. And we don't have judges and other kingdom workers with whom to take that 90% now and tithe to, do we? Because we don't have control of the kingdom. And we certainly don't want to give the tithe to judges today who are helping to destroy the kingdom. You know, God forbid that we would take judges and start passing it out to the guys down here at the courthouse. Because for the most part, they're not adjudicating kingdom law. They're adjudicating laws that are essentially helping to destroy the kingdom. However, at the same time, individually, we're still, even with that being the case, we're still individually responsible for the tithe. For our own tithing. So where should it go then today? Well, the simple answer is still to full-time kingdom workers or laborers, which in our current situation, probably for the most part, means to kingdom ministers, as we normally think of the term, who are doing their best to get us back to Christian dominion and Christian law, that one day we'll have our own judges and other workers with whom to then take this tithe. They're the ones who are the full-time kingdom workers and laborers today, trying to get us back there so that we can better distribute the money as it can go. Because it has to go somewhere. You know, if I have an individual responsibility to tithe, you have an individual responsibility to tithe, you've got to send it somewhere. Well, you've got to send it to those who today are the full-time kingdom laborers. However, at the same time, don't forget 1 Corinthians chapter 6, where the Apostle Paul admonished Christians to set up their own judiciaries, by which initially they would judge amongst themselves. Situations that would occur between one brother and another brother. Never happens. We never have problems with each other, right? We've got problems with each other all the time. Maybe more so with each other than we do those outside the body of Christ. And so there's going to be those situations. And Paul had in mind that Christians were to set up their own judiciaries initially so that they could judge amongst themselves, Christians with Christians, with an eye on the future, when they would someday also judge society in general. And therefore, with that in mind, with 1 Corinthians 6 in mind, and our current situation where men who otherwise are employed doing something else are asked, as they should be from time to time, asked to judge between brethren, listen, they should be compensated You know, here's a guy that's having to take time out from what he normally does. Let's say he cleans carpets. That's just one off the top of my head here. He puts in time into judging a situation. Listen, he should be compensated from the tithes. There is an opportunity to take the tithe, as limited as that situation may be, from what God really intends it to be. Nevertheless, here's a guy who needs to be compensated from the tithes for the time that he puts in on judging local matters. And there may be other situations in which men should also be compensated from the tithe. General men who put in their time away from, that take away from working their regular jobs, let's say, to feed their family, that they should be compensated for their kingdom work in a local situation, or if it would affect nationally as well. The tithe should there can be, and there will be, and there should be a place for the tithe to be used in that fashion, even with us where we currently are today. The second tithe, or the welfare tithe, was set up to be paid on the third and sixth year of every seventh year sabbatical cycle. In other words, Yahweh's welfare tithe, think about it, it was an every third year tithe, and only within a 7 year cycle, 2 years out of seven. The welfare tithe was to be set up in that fashion, and therefore, Yahweh's welfare tithe was not to be perpetual, except in contrast to what we have going on today, except in the rarest of situations. You know, if you've got a widow who has no other means, has no family, then obviously then there's going to be and has no means to be able to provide for herself, then she would be in the perpetual situation. But except in the rarest of situations, it was not to be a perpetual welfare system for the poor, because it was available, once again, only every 3 years. For those receiving it, and therefore for those receiving it, it would be impetus for them to become productive members in society. Don't you think if all of a sudden you got all these welfare recipients today and you say, hey, you're only going to get it every third year, or whatever, however we want to apply that principle today, or in the future, I think all of a sudden a lot of them would get pretty interested in working. That I have no reason and no desire to work at all with the way it's set up today. Again, God's system was made to work and work the way it should. Moreover, because it is a tithe, this tithe was particularly controlled locally by those who know the prospective recipients. Unlike today's welfare system, the local people in control of this situation could best determine whether they were worthy recipients or merely deadbeats and freeloaders. And say, oh, you want part of the welfare tithe? Yeah, I know about you, buddy. You ain't getting any. Not you. you see the point. They knew who was deserving and who wasn't. And thus, either way, whether given or withheld, this tithe promotes productive workers and a more overall affluent society as a whole. Now, on at least a couple and maybe three different occasions, during this series, I've been asked by people how they can fulfill this second tithe under our current situation. Because again, you want to be careful that it's going to people who deserve it, and most of our people certainly don't want to be sending it to some advertisement for who knows who in some other nation. They don't want to be sending their money to some national means because they don't have control of it. And so they've asked, how do we participate in this second tithe, this welfare tithe, under our current situation? For those who don't personally know anyone to send it to, with Malachi chapter 2, the idea of storehousing, and 2 Corinthians chapter 9 in mind, we keep as a ministry, because we have our fingers, if you will, on the pulse of our people, probably much better than the individual person does, we keep a current list of deserving widows and don't know if we had ever had any orphans on there, but poor people and needy people in either perpetual situations or many times more often than not that are only in temporary situations and are on the list only until they get out of their situations, to whom this tithe and offerings, if you prefer, can be sent. We keep a list. It changes from time to time because some people come on and then later get off, which we will either provide to those who don't have somewhere to send that tithe, or we'll send any tithe designated for that purpose on your behalf. And if you designate it for that purpose, I guarantee that's the only place it goes, is to those who have that need. Now, I prefer that you do it the former way rather than the latter. Ask for the list, I'll give you the list, and you take care of the tithe between you and them. However, we've certainly done it the other way as well. If nothing else, it relieves me of another task to take care of. So I'll provide the list if you would like to provide that tithe for the sake of welfare for the deserving poor or needy. Another dilemma our present quote-unquote Babylonian circumstances present regarding the second tithe is that, unlike Israel of old, we live today, under this Babylonian system particularly, in a much more immediate fiscal mode. That is, our financial needs are much more immediate. You know, we live not so much in an agronomist society. We don't live, except the farmers may, but the rest of us don't live in a yearly basis kind of thing. We live, you know, some from a monthly fiscal perspective, some from a weekly fiscal perspective, and some even from a daily fiscal perspective. And therefore, it would be nearly impossible, for example, under today's situation, for most widows, for example, to have to wait for the third year tithe for their financial assistance. And in fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, we have new covenant precedent for laying aside on a weekly basis for the needs of the saints. And therefore, if we combine, with that in mind, this is just at least one option under this system we currently find ourselves, if we combine the first and the second tithe, you know, and rather than doing it just on a yearly basis and an every three basis, but calculate the two, combine the two, and calculate their percentage, it comes to approximately 13.33%. 10% to go to kingdom laborers and 3.33% to qualified needy. And remember, we're still only talking about for those with an increase. That 13.33% is only for those with an increase. Now, personally, I like to make things as simple as I possibly can. I don't want to figure out 3.3%. I figure out an easy 5%, and I've rounded the 3.3 up to 5%. I'm not saying anybody has to do that, but that's what we do. And therefore, each week I take 10% and send it to another kingdom ministry or kingdom laborer, as the case may be, that's on the rotation list for them, and another 5% is sent to the next needy person in rotation on that list. And so every week 10 goes where it should go, and 5 hopefully it's going, hopefully I'm using enough discretion that both of them are going where they belong, as to the best of our knowledge. One more thing that needs to be known about this second tithe as well is that it is also designated for the Levites, or the kingdom laborers, as it would be today, as well. If, for example, if there are quote-unquote Levites today for whom the first tithe is insufficient, then they too would be included for a portion of the second tithe. Or, let's say that a particular community had a dearth of poor people. Impossible under our current economic system. And only getting worse as time goes on here. But it could be so under Yahweh's economic plan. He says we'll always have poor, there'll always be poor somewhere, but a particular community, because of God's economic plan, it's to reduce the number of poor, and perhaps one community says, hey, we don't have any poor to send this tithe to. Well, the second tithe, just like the first tithe, is still nonetheless required. And in such a situation, it would instead be given to the regular kingdom workers, just like the first tithe, or in addition to their regular tithe. God says, give it to the Levites. Give it to the kingdom workers. In other words, use it. It's a welfare tithe, but you don't have anywhere to go with it. If you've got excess after you've given it to those legitimate needy, then put it toward the kingdom in some other fashion, is basically what we could glean from that. The third tithe, or as often known as the rejoicing tithe, and an interesting tithe to say the least. And boy, I tell you, much more so. This last week I spent some time thinking about this tithe and reading and studying the scriptures that apply to it. It is a much more interesting tithe than I've ever myself even understood before. And it is once again, excuse me, a tithe from one's increase. Now that would maybe be overlooked, but I think you'll see that this is very important. That it too, it wasn't a tithe from anything but one's increase, to be spent on whatever your heart desires. Let me read. This tithe deserves a reading again. Deuteronomy 14, 22 through 27, it says, Thou shalt truly tithe all thy increase of thy seed that thy field bringeth forth year by year. Talking about the third tithe. So it's from the increase. And thou shalt eat before Yahweh thy God in the place which he shall choose to place his name there, the tithe of the corn, of the wine, of the oil, and the firstlings of thy herds and thy flocks, and thou mayest learn to fear Yahweh thy God always. Now note the reason for this third tithe. Even the rejoicing tithe, even this tithe, was to focus our attention on Yahweh, to help us fear him. Keep that in mind. And if the way be too long for thee, where thou are going to use this during one of the festivals, tabernacles, he says, if the way be too long for thee, so that thou art not able to carry it, your tithe, he says, or if the place be too far from thee, which Yahweh thy God shall choose to set his name there, when Yahweh thy God has bless thee, thou shalt thou turn it into money. Take your tithes from your sheep and your oxen and your corn and your wheat and turn it into money. If you don't want to carry it all the way to where you're headed, turn it into money. Sell it. And bind up the money in thine hand, and thou shalt go unto the place which Yahweh thy God shall choose, and thou shalt bestow that money for whatsoever thy soul lusteth after, for oxen, or for sheep, or for wine, or for strong drink, or for whatsoever thy soul desireth. And thou shalt eat there before Yahweh thy God, and thou shalt rejoice, thou and thine household, and the Levite that is within thy gates. Thou shalt not forsake him, for he has no part nor inheritance with thee. Now note first that Yahweh doesn't tell us to spend all the remaining increase on ourselves. Something, again, I think that's often overlooked about this tithe. He doesn't say, all right, you've taken care of the first tithe, you've taken care of the second tithe, so you can just spend all the rest on yourselves. No, he doesn't say that. But instead, only the tithe of thy increase is to be used for this purpose. Now, this tithe, plus the other two tithes, is equivalent to approximately 23.3% of one's increase, leaving 76.7% of one's profit, leaving 76.7% of one's profit for what, do you suppose? Well, some of it could be used for free will offerings in addition to the tithe. The Bible speaks of both, and we're not to neglect both. Or emergencies, one of the places the free will tithe could go. For others, or not as a free will offering, but just for ourselves, for emergencies. Or how about savings toward our progeny's inheritance? Or maybe most important is to take the 76.7, or what's left of it after free will offerings and emergencies, and use it for investment or reinvestment into your business. That is another ox or some equivalent thereof, as in Proverbs 14 and verse 4. And so God says, yeah, take that. But don't take 86.3% and spend it on yourselves. Take only 10% and spend it on yourselves, leaving yourself 76.7%, much of which can be reinvested in your business and in your future and your children's future. There are a couple other things that shouldn't be overlooked and that usually are about this third tithe as well. Yahweh wants all of us, doesn't he? Now, I don't mean, and yeah, I can mean this in the way I guess I can mean this too, but I'm not talking collectively. He wants all of us collectively. But he wants all of me, and he wants all of you, doesn't he? In other words, Yahweh wants his will in everything that we do. In everything that we do. Not only as it concerns what we do for an occupation. Does God want us to perform his will in an occupation? Doesn't want us involved in the mafia, does he? He wants us to do what we do, that it be, first of all, righteous or at least not unrighteous, and that we do it unto him. But not only in what we do for an occupation, but also what we do with our leisure time. He wants all of us. And in fact, the third tithe puts him in control of what we do for even our own pleasure and gratification. As it said, that we, even as we tithe to ourselves, that we're doing it because he asked us to, with him in mind, that we might even fear him more. In other words, even things we do or buy for ourselves should be done with him in mind. That is, once again, with Yahweh in mind, who gives us the power to make wealth. Not only to make a living, not only to provide for our daily needs, but to have wealth that we can spend upon ourselves and our children and our grandchildren, hopefully. And so God says, I want, here is a tithe that I have set up so that even in these things you will remember me and not forget me. Because why? That just came to mind here. You go back to Deuteronomy and you go back to Romans chapter 1, and when the people prosper, what more often than not happens? They forget God. And God set up a tithe to help us not forget him that we spend on ourselves. Furthermore, from this tithe, it appears that Yahweh doesn't want us. Now catch this. Yahweh doesn't want us spending more than 10% on such things. Why? Why doesn't he want us spending more than 10%? Well, I'm going to guess here, but I think it's because he's obviously concerned, interested in our prosperity. Because a man who only spends 10% of his profits on extracurricular activities and pleasures and uses the remaining upwards of 75% of his profits to reinvest in his business is going to eventually become a wealthy man. Even if his profits are only $100 per annum. You know, he only takes 10% of that $100 and or only 23.3%, and he takes all the rest, the majority of the rest, and uses it to reinvest. The next year he's probably going to make that much more, and the next year it keeps multiplying, and it's what's the word that where it most interest today, it compounds, and all of a sudden it's like a penny for every nail the guy puts in the shoe. If you double the penny, before long you've paid the guy thousands of dollars by the time he's done shoeing your horse. The same with this. God says you're going to become a wealthy man if you only take 10% of your profits and spend it upon yourself and your and for extracurricular, those kind of things. Also, inherent in this third tithe is that only those who have an increase are to spend 10% on themselves for the extracurricular kind of things. Why? Well, I'll bet it's because Yahweh's interested in our prosperity and doesn't want us to unnecessarily going into debt for frivolous, non-essential things and thereby becoming fiscal slaves, according to Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 7. In other words, he's saying, if he says only the 10% of the increase is to be dealt with such things, then if you don't have an increase, you don't got any business doing it. Unless you're a fool and want to go into debt for all this, whether it be new furniture, when you don't really need any furniture, the furniture you've got will get you by until you've got the money to be able to spend it. He says, don't go into debt for those things. If you've got an increase and 10% of it is enough to be able to purchase that without going into debt, fine. Use it on anything you want to. But you better have it before you spend it. Now, talk about a stimulus package to production and prosperity. No vacations. No ball games. No cable TV. No extra. Nothing. Let's just put it that way. Nothing frivolous. Unless you have an increase. And then only 10% of it can be used for those extra things. Talk about motivation. That's motivation. Not only to keep people from being a no-account bum, but also a prosperous asset to kingdom society. You know, if Americans, think about it, if Americans were to return to this one aspect, and again, people say, well, oh boy, I get to spend 10% on myself with never thinking about all these other implications here. But with this implication, if we were to return, if Americans were to return to this one aspect of Yahweh's economic system, it would economically transform, revolutionize America. So much for the credit card business. I'd like to know. I bet they've got this figure out there somewhere. How much of credit cards are on frivolous matters, non-essential things? I mean, it's got to be the greatest percentage of it. Well, it gets rid of that right off the bat. The credit card business is gone, and all the debt that's involved in it, all the slavery, economic slavery that's involved. And oh, by the way, as hard as this may be to fathom, Yahweh would have us so prosperous that we would find it difficult to spend even 10% of our increase on ourselves. That we would run out of things to buy with the 10%. There, and if that seems unfathomable, there are people, you know, that if they were to take 10% of their increase today, I mean, they get to the place where they don't know what else to buy. That's how prosperous God would have us to be. And that therefore we would use, I mean, this is inherent in the tithe, that we would use after we've done spending on ourselves. And for us that are hopefully a little bit more or less frivolous than the rest of today's society and have a little bit more common sense, perhaps it would happen without us having to be extremely wealthy anyway, and that we would run out of things to buy for ourselves, and that therefore we would use what remains of this tithe, like as with the second tithe, and we just read it, for, what did it say, for the Levites. This tithe was also for the Levites. All three tithes were for the Levites. And or today, other kingdom laborers, ministers, and other kingdom laborers as well. You know, a guy gets done spending. He says, man, there isn't anything more I want. I still got part of this 10% left over. Where does it go? God says, put it toward the kingdom again. You've taken care of your needs, now put it toward the kingdom and use it in that fashion as well, just as it would be with the second tithe if there was any left over. All of which only goes to show once again how superior Yahweh's laws, Yahweh's, in this case, Yahweh's economic laws, and His taxing system, and His taxing system, which is integral to His whole economic system, is to man's inferior, inept surrogate system that we see falling apart all around us today, the results of it. Once again, how truly perfect are Yahweh's laws, including His taxing laws, even as it concerns His rejoicing tithe to ourselves and the implications that we've just discussed therein. And there is much, much more that could be, that I could share, discuss on each of these three tithes, but we'll leave it there for now. Because before concluding this series, I said I would address the judgment for tithing as well. So quickly, because we don't have much time left, turn to Leviticus chapter 5, if you will. Leviticus chapter 5. Now, in addition to however Yahweh chooses to ultimately judge non-tithers, and the judgment that we are already experiencing individually and as a nation today for having chosen man's surrogate taxing system over Yahweh's, there's another judgment for non-tithers. Leviticus chapter 5, beginning with verse 14, it says, "And Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying," verse 15, "if a soul commit a trespass and sin through ignorance in the holy things of Yahweh," and I will say how much more so if it's not from ignorance. But he says, "if a soul commit a trespass and sin through ignorance in the holy things of Yahweh." Now we need to stop there and we need to ask the question, what are the holy things? Well, in Deuteronomy 26, 12, and 13, we find the following. It says, "And when thou hast made an end of tithing all the tithes of thine increase the third year," so we're talking about the second tithe here, "which is the year of tithing, and hast given unto the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, that they may eat within thy gates and be filled, then thou shalt say before Yahweh thy God, I have brought away the hallowed things," same word, I believe it's Kodesh, as holy things in Leviticus 5. "I have brought away all the hallowed things unto mine house, and also have given them unto the Levite, and unto the stranger, and to the fatherless, and to the widow, and according to all thy commandments which thou hast commanded me." So, at least one of the holy things that we can transgress in are the tithe. Okay, back to Leviticus 15 now, Leviticus 5, verse 15 and 16. He says, "If a soul commit a trespass and sin through ignorance in the holy things of Yahweh, then he shall bring for his trespass unto Yahweh a ram without blemish out of the flocks with the estimation by shekels of silver." It really was the estimation of it in silver. At least the Hebrews tends to bear that out. "After the shekel of the sanctuary for a trespass offering," verse 16, "and he shall make," not unlike, by the way, other transgressions, that there would also be required a sin offering with a lamb or a sheep or a goat or something. And then in verse 16 it says, "And he shall make amends." New American Standard has restitution. The word restitution should take us right back to the eighth commandment, which requires restitution. More evidence that those who aren't tithing, or that thou shalt not tithe is a statute under the eighth commandment. He says, "And thou shalt make amends," or restitution, "for the harm that he has done in the holy thing, and shall add the fifth part thereto, and give it unto the priest, and the priest shall make an atonement for him with the ram of the trespass offering, and it shall be forgiven him." Now, of course, Yeshua, as it pertains to verse 15, Yeshua was our sacrificial lamb and is both the antitype and the fulfillment of this sacrifice and all others that we find in the Old Covenant. But, as in other instances that also require a sacrifice, there is no reason for us not to bring forward into the New Covenant the second half of this judgment of an additional 20% penalty with the tithes previously withheld. For example, let's say that last year a fellow had an increase of $5,000, making his increase tithe, $500, which he failed to pay. And later he becomes convicted of his sin and wants to set things right. Well, first of all, he would obviously need to tithe the original $500 that he withheld, to which, according to this, he would then need to add, as a late payment, if you will, another $100 to satisfy the 20% judgment. And so there is a judgment for non-tithing. However, being that Yahweh's laws nowhere requires anyone to disclose his financial affairs, just as the tithe, while required, is voluntary, so it would appear is this judgment. It's a voluntary judgment. However, fail to pay it, if required, along with the original tithe, and God only knows, but the ultimate judgment that he may require of you, 20% may seem awfully inexpensive. At the very least, and we're about finished here, at the very least, there is certainly no reason not to expect, in such a situation, some of the curses found in Deuteronomy 28 to be a part of your lot if you fail to pay the tithe, and in this case, the late payment if it applies, as much as for disobeying any of Yahweh's commandments, statutes, and judgments. No reason that we shouldn't expect the curses of Deuteronomy 28. Conversely, pay what is right instead of what's left. And individually and collectively, as a nation, we can expect the blessings of Deuteronomy 28 instead. But one thing is for sure, and that I hope that you will take away from this, the one thing out of everything else that I hope you'll take away from this series, one thing is for absolutely sure, if we ever intend to take dominion back from Yahweh's enemies, along with the rest of Yahweh's commandments, judgments, and statutes, commandments, statutes, and judgments, kingdom tithing must be restored. If we're going to restore the kingdom, then we must restore Yahweh's economic plan. And kingdom tithing is integral to it. Hopefully, if nothing else, you'll take that away. All right, let's stand and close in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you, Lord, for this series, Lord, that you have finally prompted me to preach and to get into. And I have been so thrilled to learn so much again, Father, in doing so, even as it concerns this third tithe, which I never knew or never understood previous to this last week's study. Thank you for your perfect laws, including this one and all that you've given us, and help us just to have the understanding to know how to apply it in these difficult times, and then particularly in the times to come. Prepare us men who will prepare men, Father, for someday taking